Blog Talk Radio.
Golden dreaming beauty man, if it's only fantasy. Sometimes one can't help but wonder, will it ever truly be? Some people keep on saying, all is illusion and lies. Why is it so hard to believe there are better days to see? So it seems like the world is tumbling down. It's the darkest time of night. Right before dawn, here comes the time of the dawn. Here comes the time of the dawn. Here comes the time where all the people will unite and share in a wonderful world. Here it comes. Here comes the day where wisdom and harmony will fill the earth. Here comes.
Yes, blessed souls, here it comes. We're live because we're blessed to stay alive. Bech Torah Chesed, instructions of life toward Chesed, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies, and Torah Chaim, instructions of life. You're now tuned into what we would suggest to be the, in our humble opinion, the higher inner frequency of blogtalkradio.com. We call ourselves Soul Class. This is Soul Class 561 Secular by Design Program, Presentation 56. Baruch Hashem, blessed is our Creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience with Creator's hope. We're now broadcasting live at 9:32 a.m., live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA Unified Soul Actualization. Program content will focus on a reading from Alan W. Cecil's Secular by Design, a Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, which can be purchased if you go to goodreads.com, GoodReads.com, /book/show/181266658, and then just type in Secular by Design. Our call number, if you want to chime in and make the show a little bit more organic and spontaneous, is 347-838-869. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones. The tags for today's program are Eternal Creator, Divine Image, Universal Redemption, Children of Israel, Collaborating with Children of Noah to Eradicate Hatred, Jealousy, and Unnecessary Competition, Alan W. Cecil, and Seven Universal Commandments. And now we have to turn down the music, but here comes the time to lower the music from Blessed Brother Soul and Spirit and Prayer Partner, Rabbi Isaac Baton, the President of Beit Mazal, located at 1433. President Street in the Carnot section of Brooklyn, New York, located between Kingston Avenue and Albany Avenue. Prayers for the Blessed Shabbat, one that's coming this weekend, is at 10 o'clock. We can hear authentic Jewish, North African, Sephardic chanting to ancient Israelite liturgy. But let's just turn on the music and get on with the show. And as we do, we're going to welcome in the actual author of this wonderful book, this seminal work, this book to open up the minds of the masses, whether it be intellectuals or social activists or whatever type of person he or she or you may be, but souls, because you can read this book because you have a divine image. Joining me right now is author of Secular by Design, a Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. Here's Alan.
Thank you, Don. Yes, we have a really big shoe today, so let's get rolling.
Okay. Let's get right into it. We have to take you, blessed souls, within the context of what we're talking about at the beginning of the section of the book, which starts on page 104, All Roads Lead from Rome. Alan quoted in a very copious manner from Edward Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, where there are just outright attacks at every point, it seems, that he found the opportunity to attack the Jewish people and the Jewish faith. And so we'll go right into page 108. As we see, Alan illustrates not only Gibbon's example, an example of Gibbon's anti-Semitism. The Jews irreconcilable hatred of mankind, instead of flaming out in acts of blood and violence, evaporated in less dangerous gratifications. They embraced every opportunity of overreaching the idolaters in trade, and they pronounced secret, ambiguous imprecations against the haughty kingdom of Edom, according to the false Josephus. Tsepho, the grandson of Esau, conducted into Italy the enemy of Aeneas, the king of Carthage, another colony of the Idumeans. The flying from the sword of David took refuge in the dominions of Romulus. For these are other reasons of equal weight, the name of Edom was applied to the Jews, to the Roman Empire. And that's quoting from page 404 in the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Reading further, from the Jewish point of view, it was not so simply that descendants of Esau founded Rome. The Edomite spirit, the spirit of violence and war, permeated Roman culture. Along with this tendency for violence to rule others by strength, Rome also inherited Esau's hatred for his brother Jacob. Along with adopting much of the Greek culture, Rome also adopted the Greek penchant for anti-Semitism. In the 4th century, when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, the theological hatred that Christianity had for the Jews fused with the deeper hatred of Esau. This is the theme that Maurice Samuel wrote about in his book, You Gentiles, the difference between the focused and implacable evil of Esau and the spirituality of Jacob. Alan, we find also a modern parallel, unfortunately, in the 20th century, where Mein Kampf, written by Hitler, was actually translated into Arabic to further fan the fires of hatred of those Arabs or those leaders of the Arabs who felt that their greatest enemy, even before the forming of the State of Israel, was the Jews. So I would also say that this type of mentality of fusing hatred towards our people combined with modern ideas has been a potent weapon to try to hurt us. And ultimately, it also backfires. I mean, today you see it on the Children and All because, unfortunately, I saw there's a person by the name of, I think, Walid Shoubait, who is showing evidence of the carnage that the Christians are experiencing at the hands of these extremists in the Middle East. I mean, chopping off heads and just, demeaning them in every way possible. One can only wonder if something of Mein Kampf got into their heads as well as whatever way they interpret the Quran. But again, that's not something new because, again, as you pointed out, the fusion of the dominant empire with any means of infusing further hatred towards the truth of the Torah, it seems to have always been a potent weapon to use against ourselves and the children of Noah.
Well, yeah, and this has been the problem. The culture, Western culture, had been so infused from centuries of teaching by the church about the Jews, about this anti-Semitism. When people read Gibbon, they really didn't bat an eye because that was the message that they've always heard. And, if you go back and read Martin Luther, the founder of the Protestant sect of Christianity, he wrote a pamphlet called Against the Jews, and he says the same thing. They should cut off their heads, burn down the synagogues, afflict them in all ways possible. I mean, this was the mainstream message of Christianity for centuries. And so when Gibbon's book came out, it didn't bother them because this is the message they've always heard. And that continued, sadly, until the 20th century, actually, until the present day, is something that has just been infused in culture.
True. Going further into your book, other historians followed a Gibbon's example. We've just been talking about that. And described the Jews as a historical fossil, a prehistoric and peculiar people, pickled and preserved by their unswerving loyalty to archaic laws and customs that Jesus had graciously nullified, a religion whose only useful contribution to society is the preamble to the New Testament, has been made over 2,000 years ago. Now, I have to just stop for a moment, Alan, and say, first of all, I don't consider myself a fossil. People might find me peculiar in that I like pickles more than probably the average person. But, just with that one strong, broad brush of the pen, that the archaic laws and customs Jesus had graciously nullified, did he come to nullify love your neighbor as yourself, doing charity, to keeping the Sabbath? I mean, you know, it's so erroneous in this quasi-intellectual expression, as you have brought out in the various examples of Gibbon's writings, that has nothing to do with the truth. It's like almost like a euphoric, delusionary type of projection upon another people without really looking into the facts of. I mean, I'm sure these there was a Rabbi Yaakov Emden, for instance, who lived at the beginning of the, I think at the end of the 17th century and the beginning of the 18th century, who actually was saying that Yeshua, Jesus, whatever people want to call him, was actually a devout follower of the Torah. So even from the Jewish perspective, from certain rabbinical points of view, he didn't nullify anything. Yet these guys throw this mishmash out that he did this and he did that, and the only thing the Old Testament was serving as a preamble to the New Testament. Well, it's a bunch of hogwash. Your take on these matters?
Yeah, first, I apologize for the consonants of that line about the pickled people. it's just fun to say out loud, you know.
Right.
These historians, all these people, they don't go to the primary sources. They just follow the line of the teaching, the theological teachings of the church. And they, time and time again, I mean, one example after the other, they look at what on earth, you know, they don't go to the primary. And then here's a Jewish rabbi who decided to go to the primary source, you know, well, I'm going to read the New Testament and see what all this is about. Yeah, and you know, you read it and you're astonished. You're like, what on earth is all this fuss about? You know, there are some places in the New Testament which I think were put in much later, probably in the second century, like Matthew 23, that are very anti-Jewish. But it's really funny coming from a man who, you know, when they were quoting his actual words, talking about the Torah and everything, showed, yeah, he was one with the Jewish people. He loved the Jews. He wasn't against them at all. But they, modern culture, the historians, the philosophers, they all followed the teachings of the church instead of going to the primary sources, going to a rabbi. Hey, what's this all about?
Reading further in your book, Alan, to show one of the, I guess we call it, and we say in the Hebrew, Talmidim, or students of Gibbon, was none other than the famous works of Arthur Toynbee, in his day a well-known British historian whose popularity has waned in recent decades. Toynbee viewed Judaism as an archaic leftover from bygone and primitive religions that, quote-unquote, Judaism is a fossil of the extinct Syriac civilization. That's from Toynbee's A Study of History, Volume 2, page 402. This labeling of the Jews as being a Syriac civilization was no doubt influenced by Voltaire, who said that, quote-unquote, the Jews spoke a jargon half Phoenician and half Syriac, rhymed. Therefore, the great and powerful nations under whom they were in slavery rhymed also. We cannot help believing that the Jews, who, as we have frequently observed, adopted from everything from their neighbors, adopting from them also rhyme. This is from Voltaire's Works of Voltaire, Contemporary Version, Volume 7, page 89, which I'd like to say is a contemporary distortion. Listen, we've always been a people that held to our roots, but as long as neighboring nations we intermingled with had something positive to offer, as we say, who is a wise man who learns from every other person? So So Toynbee takes the point, Alan, that we're just a bunch of copycats. This stuff is like, you know, I get it. I read this stuff, it's like, this is not how I understand us, to be copycats of the nations. We're supposed to, you know, embolden ourselves and embolden the nations to the Torah and the seven Noahic commandments, that they should engage in it and create a civil society. But the copycats, unfortunately, are those Jews who have lost their traditions, have become, unfortunately, ashamed of being Jewish. So I don't know if maybe Toynbee was observing non-observant Jews in his days. I don't know. Any take on these matters?
Well, the non-Jewish society of the time took what you're saying in a slightly different manner. he who is wise, who learns from every other person, unless they're Jewish. That's the way the non-Jewish secular society looks at it. And, you know, they read Voltaire, they read Greek, you know, they were brought up in the church. And that's the stuff they've always heard. Yeah, Jews just steal, you know, they're you know, all into making money, blah, blah, blah. All these caricatures, that's what they believe is the truth. They never go to the primary sources. They don't look into it by themselves. A little later in the book, I bring out one scholar that, in a rare instance of scholarship, actually did go to the primary sources, a German economist named Werner Sombart, and his take on the Jews was totally different from anyone else at the time. So, but the vast majority of the people were, you know, these scholars, Toynbee. Yeah, I mean, here's a British historian, very well respected, you know, in the mid-20th century, he came out with these books, you know, about the history of the West. And yet, you know, very well researched, and that all these historians, they research well unless it has to do with the Jews. And their research is only from, you know, Christian and or secular sources. They never go to the primary sources.
Yeah. Alan, actually, we have a caller. I'd like to bring him or her on. Maybe they'll have a question. Maybe they'll have a comment. And then we'll see how. Again, I invited anyone to come on to make it a little more organic. The program, Dennis, as you know, is on vacation right now, I think somewhere in Europe. So let's just call on the caller to see what he or she might have to say or just want to listen in. Let's see. Good morning, Blessed Soul. Oh, they hung up. They didn't want to talk. Okay, the cat got their tongue. Let's go further then. The message here was that the Jews were unoriginal, according to Toynbee. They freely borrowed, or as I put in parentheses, or stole from their neighbors' ideas and literary devices. Even their language was not their own. That's a very interesting comment. I'd like to comment on that in a moment. It was rare indeed that you see historians belittle the Greeks for stealing the alphabet and literary devices from the Phoenicians, but to the little Jews was a common occurrence. I'd like to remind our listening audience that the Chassam Sofer, who was a great Jewish halachic authority, in commenting on the Tower of Babel in the book of Genesis, which you can go and read, mentioned that the common language of the world, as I guess we would understand, I guess English or maybe Chinese are the two most popular languages in the world today, and I guess Arabic is probably a close third, the common language of the peoples in those days, which is over about 4,000 or a little less than 4,000 years ago, was Hebrew. But there wasn't a nation of Hebrews. There wasn't a nation of Israelites. There wasn't a nation of Jews, so to speak. You had at the time of the Tower of Babel, that incident, which I believe was 1,996 years into the creation since Adam and Eve, that everyone spoke the same language until the Creator saw that the children of men were rebelling against God. That Tower of Babel was, in their delusionary, illusionary minds, was to rebel against the Creator. And by divine providence, we became the maintainers of this language. So if Toynbee or any of the historians want to say that we stole their language, no, you forgot your original language. Alan, any comment on this?
Well, yeah, I would really... If there is a scholarly study on Hebrew and the effect it has, I've seen some books that go into part of this, but there's a lot to be said about the original Hebrew and, you know, trying to find it from a linguistical point of view. Take the word eretz, which in Hebrew is earth, right? Think of the consonants, you know, the R, the RTZ, the Aleph, Resh, and Tzadi, and think of earth, it's the same consonants. You know, here's an ancient word for earth, and the word we use for earth, you know, can denote the planet or the, you know, the soil, the earth, the land. It's the same word, basically. And how old is the word Eretz? I mean, that is an ancient word, and yet we use it today you know, with an English pronunciation to denote the same thing.
True. One other thing is very interesting that the alphabet that we say today, representing the English language, which is basically only about 1,000 years old, being the distillation of the mixing of the Anglo and Saxon tribes, Germanic tribes in Europe. The alphabet in Hebrew is called Aleph Bet. So again, we see here that it's not who, you know, no, the Jews don't, we don't accuse the Greeks or the English or the Anglians and the Saxons. We just, okay, you want to call it alphabet? Fine. We know it as the Aleph Bet. You know, you change around the syllable and a couple of letters. But it's all about human language. Anyway, it just amazes me how this cognitive dissonance which exists, and I know that those people who do choose, whether they be Jewish or the B'nai Noah, to want to learn the Hebrew, they find that they get a certain inner awakening if they choose to pursue the, you know, to get scholarly about learning the language. Because it is, even though it's not exactly, even the Hebrew that I speak today is not exactly as what you would call the Lashna Kodesh, as say like Moses would speak it, but if he were to come back today, or someone from 2,000 years ago were to come back today, I would be able to carry on a conversation with them, although they might not be familiar with words like, say, what a computer is, a machashev, or a telephone, which is a cell phone. But big deal, you know. They used words that I wouldn't understand. But generally speaking, we would both say to each other, shalom aleichem, peace upon you, hello, how you doing? Anyway, I just wanted to add that point. Further into Allen's book, although arguably not as influential as Oswald Spengler, and that Spengler published his first work, Toynbee's popularity during the middle of the 20th century wielded great influence in popular culture. Borrowing on Spengler's theme of cyclic civilizations, and here Allen is quoting from W.K. Lowther Clark's A Concise Bible Commentary from 1952, page 303. Toynbee's great work is written to illustrate the thesis that civilizations are born, grow, decay, and finally pass away. The process is there for all to see, but it may be interpreted differently, for a civilization may always be dying, yet always being reborn. For example, the old Greco-Roman, which quote-unquote died and was succeeded by Western civilization, may be viewed as slowly passing into the latter phase, for most of our characteristic ideas and institutions have their roots in it. The renaissance of ancient Mediterranean civilization is enough to prove this, and the Western languages, politics, architecture all go back to Greece and Rome. Toynbee labeled Judaism as a fossil, a religion clinging to its archaic and quote-unquote fulfilled laws of Moses and not tossing them aside for Christianity, a cultural relic that outlived its usefulness when Christianity arrived. Toynbee does not simply echo the Greek distaste for anything Hebrew. There are distinct theological motifs within his work. Toynbee's attitude towards Judaism was lost on Jewish scholars. Maurice Samuel wrote critiques on Toynbee's history during the height of Toynbee's popularity, criticizing Toynbee's attitude towards Jews and Judaism. And here Allen quoted from Maurice Samuel, The Professor and the Fossil, published in 1956, page 73. When we collate the numerous and often repetitious passages on the Jews in the study of history, we discover behind the arabesques of erudition three familiar and rather sharp-worn ideas. Quote, that there has only been one episode of value in Jewish history, the prophetic. Two, that the spiritual fatal mistake of the Jews was the rejection of Christianity. Three, that this rejection that they condemned themselves to everlasting sterility. Whew, that's pretty sharp analysis by Samuel, but you know what? Just the opposite. We keep on growing. And I'm not saying it's bad or good, but actually the Muslim or the Islam faith is actually growing more than Christianity in our day and age, despite the fact that there are some people who are giving Islam a pretty bad name with all these acts of terrorism. Any comment on these matters?
Well, if you look at the whole sterility factor, I mean, which culture is really sterile? The Western culture has been influenced by Christianity for 2,000 years now. And, you know, it's so many of these same ideas that the Greeks and Romans had, their anti-Semitism, especially the Romans. You know, you have to remember that Rome conquered so much of Western Europe, the Mediterranean, Northern Africa, and there was really just one little tiny country that stood up to them and fought like the Dickens to keep them out, and that was Israel or Judea at the time. And it took them over 100 years to finally subdue these people. They hated the Jews. You know, they erected, look at today in Rome, you still see the Arch of Titus commemorating the destruction of the temple. I mean, they were so proud that they finally beat the Jews, they erected this huge, huge monument that still stands today. And, you know, along the top, you could see them looting the temple, taking out the temple menorah and everything. To me, it is Western civilization, you know, with the ideas that they have, that is the sterile thing. And you look at Islamic civilization, they're just as bad. I mean, their high point in their culture was probably about, 900 years ago? Long time ago. They have not really progressed in their ideology since then.
Unfortunately not. Alan, at this point, we're going to be closing out the program, and I'd like to thank you once again for using one of your most valuable commodities, your precious time, to come on for the past 26 minutes. I really appreciate it, because you as the author really can bring out points that only you can, because you are the author of such a book, and I'm just kind of adding my own editorial comments to try to assist people to realize that you know, it's time to reevaluate what we are in the West, and that we can, in fact, fuse the best things that Western civilization have offered with the 613 commandments, and as well, and how much more so, because the predominant peoples living in the West are the children of Noah. I'm talking about the actual lineage. I don't want to get into any levels. Just, you know, those who are not of the nation of Israel are the children of Noah, which is a very hallowed and blessed, you know, pedigree. Just as the Jews have, we have a unique pedigree, the children of Noah have a pedigree, because we've all been created by Creator. So with that being said, Alan, any last words before we sign out today?
You know, it's really interesting. In the Hebrew text of the Decalogue of the Ten Commandments, that whole section contains 620 letters. That's 613 plus 7.
And we know what the 7 correspond to.
That's right. 7 laws of Noah and 613 mitzvot of Judaism.
Right. And as written in many different ways in the Tanakh, if you seek it, you shall find it. But if people don't seek it, Alan, they're just oblivious to it. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. And bless those of you who have been listening out there. Hopefully you'll do your own research on what Alan and I just said for this past 30 minutes or so. We're going to end off, as we usually do, with our segue ending music of Brother David Dome out in Jollyhaugh, England. The name of the song is Let Us Be Friends. But before we sign off, I do want to mention to everyone that today's program has been dedicated to the Refuah Shlema of my father, Reb Shlomo Yaakov, who today is being Shlomo Yaakov ben Esther, Leah Shalom, may she rest in peace, my grandmother, my father's mother. My father has been in the hospital the last couple of weeks, and now he's going to be transferred to a rehab, where hopefully he'll be able to accomplish everything in a peaceful and pleasant manner, and then resume back living at his normal residence. So I wish today's program was in his merit, because I know he's a person that does not like distortions to be spread into the creation. Hopefully we've removed some of those distortions. And hopefully we're going to be ending today's program in a way of a Havachad, one love, Goralachad, one destiny, Kolanu for all of us, but Darki Noam, in a pleasant way, Darki Shalom, in a peaceful way. And just remember, Basil, you've got to be good. And even though that might generate some anxiety and angst and paradoxical feelings within yourself, Atev Tov Lehiti, the nature of the good is to do good, and the Creator is the source of all good. And therefore, he can empower all of us to be friends and to stabilize this blessed planet, which certainly needs a good dose of stabilization. And one of the ways to do it is through the 613 commandments if you're a Jew, and if you're one of the blessed children of Noah, the 7 Noahic commandments. Take care, everyone. difficulty. We're going to restart the song. Hold on, blessed souls. Hold on. Let's get the song cooking again. Hold on, please. Just another moment. Technical difficulties. What can you do? Murphy's Law strikes again. Here we go. David Domes, let's be friends. Or let us be friends.